44th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name, as always, is Kalen Egan.
My name is Travis Centel. I'm pumped. I'm psyched. I'm back on track. I'm reinvigorated. I'm just stoked to do
You're
this.
You're back for the show. This is great.
I just want to apologize for not being back for a while.
We've litigated it, man.
I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
Can I tell you something? Here's how I'm feeling today.
Yeah.
I'm going to go. Here's my character for the episode.
Oh, God.
I'm going to go low energy.
Yeah. I'm high. I'm feeling stoked.
You go high. I go low.
Yep. We're the Obamas of the podcast world. Let's do this.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons I'm stoked is that I think I'll just take credit for this, have pulled a really interesting, smart, cool movie, a one I am super stoked to see again. I've seen it maybe 5 times. You've probably seen it 50, I'm guessing, or some crazy amount.
You have pulled... What?
It sounded like your dad voice for a second. Dallas, you have pulled.
You've pulled, I think, the first movie from the banner year of 1999, which was a mega year for film. And certainly one of the most important film years in my life. And this may be the best movie from 1999. So it's a real doozy. Mm-hmm. I think it was my favorite at the time of 99, which was also the year of Fight Club, which was the year of, you know, Magnolia. Just trust me when I say it was a big year, even if I can't think of more stuff, but I'll think of it as we go. Yeah. Three Kings.
Okay.
What?
I said no need, and then you kept naming films. I thought, well, good. We'll just stick on this for a while.
But this movie had a major impact on me. Was very, very. It's a masterpiece. It's a fucking masterpiece. Yeah. It was the first movie by Spike Jones. The first time we ever knew Charlie Kaufman's name. Just everything about it is incredible. So I said to Travis before we started this episode, I bet you I could record this episode without watching the movie because it's so familiar to me. That said, I haven't watched it in years.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't really know.
I want to go back and revisit it now that we've had some experience in adapting sort of weird premises into films and seeing some of the pitfalls you can run into while constructing non-linear, this is not linear, but confusing ideas, non-traditional ideas into screenplays and trying to make them work in a traditional storytelling capacity. I'm really excited to revisit that and look at it from a craft perspective.
Is this going to be too POMO?
Oh.
Is it going to be too POMO?
I think it's going to be perfectly POMO. Perf POMO.
Perf POMO perf.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I expect that just because it does come out of an era, but it's not necessarily dated in the way.
Well, and what I remember. I
think other movies might be.
You're right. It's people have chased being John Malkovich. They've chased Charlie Kaufman, but they've never gotten it. And they've never done it the same. And, you know, I cry at being John Malkovich. Mm-hmm. So it's got a pure kind of sincere river of real human emotion underneath all
special sauce,
quirky
man.
Craziness.
That's
you know?
A special sauce of Charlie Kaufman.
I know.
That's what he does. I don't know how he does it, but I'm going to find out. I'm going to crack the movie this time when I watch it.
Oh, great.
I'm going to sit down. I'm going to crack it. I'm going to tell you how it's done. I'm going to tell you the formula of this film.
I can't wait. I have a lot to say, but I figure, you know, what the hell? Why don't we just wait till after the movie?
Yeah, I think this will probably be a strong back-end episode. Oh, Jesus, that was a gross phrase.
Strong back-end?
Episode, I was going to say. But then I thought that phrasing didn't come out right. It'll be a strong second half. Let me start that over. There'll be a longer second half of this episode. Jesus Christ. It's gonna be a great.
Tell me what
stay
you
tuned.
Tell me that fact you told me about the word oxymoron.
Hey, this is a good fact. You guys ready?
Yeah.
So allegedly, in the Latin derivation, oxy means sharp, and moron means dull. So the word oxymoron is in itself an oxymoron.
How crazy is that?
That feels like a good being John Malkovich fact.
Synecdoche, New York.
Yeah, that's great. Real quickly, just refresh my memory. Was John Malkovich the first talent pitched for this?
Yes.
He was. It was written John Malkovich.
To the point where, and I don't know what the truth of this is, but they sort of said, like, we're not doing this if we can't get John Malkovich.
That is fucking amazing.
And they did.
And Gross Point Blank was what year, remind me? Before this, right?
Earlier.
Yeah. Okay.
But High Fidelity may have been 99 or 2000. Yeah, it might be 2000. Yeah. The other thing that is interesting for us to go in thinking about, I think, at least for me, is that this screenplay of Being John Malkovich was kicking around for a long time and was quite a bit more fantastical and elaborate and big.
That's interesting.
And when Spike Jonze got involved, he gave it shape and the proper kind of volume of crazy and the proper scope. And he really, as much as anything, I think, in this movie, shaped kind of how Charlie Kaufman approached storytelling from then on.
Oh, that's a really good conversation.
Yeah.
Because this is two very idiosyncratic, specific auteur types kind of coming together for their first big hit. And we've learned to parse out who does what and what kind of style they each have based on later projects that they've done sort of on their own.
Right.
But this is a really, really sort of masterful
I want to talk a lot about that because I don't know intimately what the screenplay was before it became a film, but I've read it and I remember certain things about it. So it'll be fun to sort of talk through some of that stuff. But let's do that in the second part of this show.
Okay, stay tuned. Here we go.
Malkovich, 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 Malkovich. Malkovich! Malkovich. 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 Malkovich! 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 Malkovich!
Is it going to be hard for you to be low-key man about a movie you like so much?
It's not going to be hard. Also, I remembered Fight Club.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
And American Beauty.
Yeah.
Not that great.
Uh-huh.
And Election.
Election's cool.
It's just like The Matrix.
Matrix. Did not say The Matrix.
Wait, did I just say Fight Club again?
Yeah.
I meant to say The Matrix.
You confused The Fight Club.
When
the
I said in my head, the I Fight thought Club, The Matrix, the Fight and Club. I said Fight Club.
Yeah, it's weird. Definitely a good way to start this back end of... Being John Malkovich, our loaded back end.
The other thing I should have said beforehand, one thing I remember, and I only remembered it while I was watching the movie, is that when I came out, I saw it in San Francisco with my dad, an opening weekend, probably that Saturday.
Okay.
And it was the only place that was where it was showing. And when we came out, we were walking back to the car, and a guy in a convertible like whistled and catcalled
you
to me. Oh. I was 15.
Can you recreate the catcall?
I will not do that, but it was something, the words that he spoke were something like, please get in the car, I love redheads, please, please.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, things have changed.
What percent
I went in and I came out and things have changed.
What percent tempted were you?
0% okay. Tempted.
Right. I just want to know.
But not against it. I was like, this is great.
Yeah, I get it.
And I knew, like, look, he knew I was a child.
Yeah, but that was the first time you'd ever been catcalled.
I was like,
flattering.
Very flattering. Yeah. And I was like, all right, yeah, like this, I could live this way.
Yeah.
With, you know, just being an object of desire.
Yeah.
And that's the way I chose to live the rest of my
ladies,
of my life.
Female and I guess certain male listeners, if you haven't seen Kalen, please Google his beautiful face.
I wish you could see me when I was 15.
You would catcall the shit out of this guy at 15. I find this will probably be a sort of a hard movie to talk about in certain ways.
I was hoping you would take the baton.
Yeah, there. I'll take it. I feel like it's a tough movie to discuss because it does for me exist out of time a little bit. It doesn't feel especially rooted in the late 90s to me. It's about things that are timeless.
Well, we didn't talk about when you first saw it. Like, what was your, at the very, like, what was your first experience seeing it?
College. I was in college. And I saw it in the theater. And then I saw it on DVD a couple times after. I don't know that I've actually watched it that closely. Because I think in previous, or sort of subsequent viewings since the theater, we're probably like, you know, it was on and I was watching and doing other stuff maybe. Or, you know, I don't know that I've given it that close of a watch, at least in the last 8 to 10 years. So it was a very pleasurable revisit for me.
Yeah.
I think
did it hit you when you first saw it? Do you remember that?
I remember being blown away by it. I remember being blown away by how many ideas, and I've had I had a similar experience today, but there's just so many ideas, and it seems to pack so much more movie into a same amount of time as other movies at the time.
It feels like a novel.
There's so much movie.
It felt to me this time more than, you know, for the first time ever, like almost like it had the feeling of it being adapted from a much bigger book.
Yeah.
And there's almost a feeling watching the movie, and I don't mean this as a negative, although I think it may actually sound like that, where it's like they had to cut out a lot of stuff because there's so much in the book, and you're like, oh man, I wish they'd done that thing, that weird thing from the book that I loved. But it just feels completely overflowing.
Yeah, it is jam-packed. And it's one of those things where, again, we find this with sci-fi premises also, that it's, I think a lesser screenwriter would have made a movie out of the first act, or maybe the first act and a half.
Which we have seen.
Yeah.
In the wake of Being John Malkovich, we've seen that exact problem.
This thing just creates scenarios, creates ideas, abandons them, moves on, pushes the limit, goes crazy. It just goes and goes and goes and
abandons
goes.
Them, but for the fact that it's no idea goes unanswered. They never drop something. They never put something in only for it to be like random. Like I was fucking around when I said, like, will this movie be too postmodern? Of course not, because it is so rooted in execution and sincerity that nothing is thrown away. This is not a Godardian exercise in kind of like, you know, flights of fancy. Like that, like for a movie as fanciful, it's never light. It's never throwaway. It's never disposable. No idea goes unanswered. And I mean, like, I've seen this movie countless times, and if you haven't seen it countless times, maybe you're at a bit of a disadvantage here, but I strongly recommend doing
that. Are you antagonizing our audience here?
No, not at all. I'm just saying that, like, I've seen it so many times, and yet this time I saw one thing I had literally never noticed.
What is that thing?
It was that when it's so dumb, and I don't know why it, I mean, it's just because I hadn't noticed it, I guess, but like when he's stuffing her in the cage with the monkey, she yells, he's putting me in a cage.
Yeah.
And then at the beginning of the movie, when she's putting the bird away, she's taught it to say, she's putting me in a cage.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so, and she goes, isn't that cute? I taught that to him today.
That's amazing.
And then she yells it when he puts her in a cage.
That's so great.
And it's just like, everything is like that. Every little thing suddenly plays and pays off. You think, oh, haha, she says that the monkey has childhood trauma.
Yeah.
No,
it does.
It's going to give you a sequence where you see the monkey's childhood.
Well, let's
and it's going to mean something and matter.
Let's tag team.
Sorry,
this,
I'm low key.
Synopsis.
I'm low key.
No. Let's tag team the synopsis here. So this is a movie about a puppeteer played by John Cusack, who's married to a dowdy, frumpy woman named Lottie, played by a frumpy Cameron Diaz with frizzy hair. Does not have a job, and he goes to get a job at this really weird company located on the 7.5 floor. 7.5. How would you say that?
Yeah.
The floor 7.5. Where he meets a odd cadre of quirky characters that somehow suit the tone of this film perfectly. They're all sort of real/not real. And you're in this, but you're very comfortably in a space that feels cohesive.
It's magical.
Yeah.
And it really is, because, and let's not just blow past that. And I would rather talk about it now rather than circle back, because this is about establishing the movie. And so we might as well do it here.
Okay.
This movie exists in an alternate dimension. Yeah. I mean, it's
hyper reality.
But
it's
no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Go.
An alternate dimension where it asks you to correspond the things that you understand from your world. I don't mean this. I don't mean literally like it exists in an alternate dimension, but it might as well, because the things that he's a struggling puppeteer and he does puppet shows on the street for money. All right, I know what a struggling musician is. I know I know how that would play in our world. It's exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same. So everything is like that in the movie, where this is a world where these things happen to exist. This is their reality. Nobody questions anything. It's all totally, totally appropriate to the context and that they have lived in for their entire lives. And the fun of it is kind of getting your footing. But once you have it, it's not like the movie's going to keep surprising you with incongruous details. It sets up a world.
It's surprising congruous details, which is, I think, the remarkable thing about this film.
Yes,
is that
that's right.
The second you step into the world, in so many films, and I understand why. I don't think this is a slight against the other films as much as it is sort of applause and pats on the back for Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze. But it's so hard to keep a consistent tone when you're not in reality, when you're in heightened reality, or as Kaelin portrays it, in alternate dimension. I feel like it's very hard to hit that right with every line of dialogue, every character choice, especially when everyone is so relentlessly quirky that no one really stands out. They're all in the same color palette of the film, which is, I think, one of the things that makes this film a masterpiece is it's pitched right. Everything's sort of pitched right.
Yeah.
Anyway, he gets a job, discovers a tunnel in his office.
Importantly, he falls in love with somebody in his workplace.
It's a woman named Catherine Keener, who is...
the actress named Catherine Keener.
It's a woman who plays a woman named Maxine.
Maxine.
There's a woman named Catherine Keener you should know about. She's an actress. She's very good.
I hope you get to meet her someday.
Yeah, she's great. Cat Keen. Unrequited, obviously, and she kind of strings him along and toys with him. And John Cusack is playing this amazingly perfect, sort of pitch-perfect, bumbling, doofus guy. Who's overly sincere, which is the perfect character choice for this guy.
Yeah.
So anyway, he discovers a tunnel. He goes into the tunnel in the office on the 7th and a half floor and ends up in John Malkovich's head and realizes it's a portal that you spend 15 minutes as John Malkovich, then it puts you out on the New Jersey Turnpike. And then he goes home and tells his wife. And Catherine Keener, just jump in. I'm just...
No, go ahead.
Catherine Keener and says, oh, this... She, first of all, he tells her, hey... Do you know what happened to me? She's like, I don't really care. He goes, I was in John Malkovich's head. I've got a tunnel in my office. And he tells the whole thing. And she's like, he's like, this is an existential disaster. And who am I? And do we have a soul? And she's like, I don't really care what
she
you're saying.
Care.
But then, interestingly, and only in this movie would this work, where she seems disbelieving and uninterested in what he says. Then she calls him and says, do you want to make some money off this?
Well,
implying that she actually believes it.
Well, she believes it, and she's sat and thought about the angle.
What a crazy thing. But only in this movie would that happen, where this woman is like, I guess, in her real world.
Well, that's the thing, and that's why I wanted to belabor discussing the setup, because Charlie Kaufman knows that the premise is not going to work if you have to have the conversations about, like, what?
Yes.
Like, are you crazy? You're in whose head? What is this thing?
Yeah.
What does this mean? Do we call the cops? Like, none of that shit. All of that is going to delay and derail the story he wants to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I mean, I don't know that this is his cognitive process, but by building an act, almost a full first act of context for the world, context for the characters, their hopes and dreams, their relationships, you know, statuses... you don't stop and be like, wait, she didn't ask him about this thing. She's just going, you know, you don't really, that's gone. You kind of understand that that's not the rules we're playing with here and that we're existing in a reality that we're just going to kind of have to keep rolling with to understand. And it forgives everything. It just lets him get on with it.
Yeah. And this is plenty of idea for a film. And yet instantly he moves on to a new plot point, which is, John Cusack's dowdy wife, Lottie, wants to try it. And she goes and she meets Catherine Keener and she's like, oh, is this your partner? She's very pretty. And then she goes into John Malkovich's body, comes out, you know, moments later and says, I think I'm a transsexual because it felt right to be a man. This is now early second act, like top of second act. And all of a sudden we're in a new thing, a new idea. And that's the moment.
But oh boy, is it just getting started. Yeah.
But that for me watching, and maybe we'll just go talk as we go here, but that was one of the moments in the film. I just thought, holy shit. Like, that's so smart.
You're, as a normal viewer, I mean, I've seen more movies now. And I want to talk about the difference between seeing this when I was young and seeing it now. But I've seen, obviously, more movies in the, you know, intervening 17, 18 years or whatever. And it really struck me watching it that I'm conditioned with a film like this to wait for it to start running on fumes.
Mm-hmm.
And to wait for it to slow down, catch its breath, just spin its wheels in an idea for a minute, for whatever purpose. You know, mm-hmm. maybe it has something it wants to investigate. But it is such a thrilling experience to be constantly discovering
yeah.
new content and new ideas, none of which feel out of context, none of which feel unearned. They just don't, they just never stop.
It just keeps
and
going.
And they all build upon one another to be toward incredibly a cohesive thematic experience and a emotional experience. None of them derail you mm-hmm. off of the trajectory of the character arcs and the narrative arc, but it's just never ending fresh ideas.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I mean, you know, I don't know how he does it except to say that he is very pure in terms of following a muse and a feeling, and he is able to tether all of this stuff to an undercurrent of very personal mm-hmm. you know, feeling, depression, despair, self-criticism, self-loathing,
yeah, hating yourself, yeah.
angst about the world,
yeah,
like
yeah.
artistic, you know, he goes so far as to call the main artistic expression in the film, this puppeteer guy has an act, and it's called Craig's Dance of Despair and Disillusionment.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, funny. Totally what's going on.
Oh, absolutely.
It's Charlie Kaufman's Dance of Despair and Disillusionment,
yeah, yeah.
which has been his entire career. But the ability to laugh at it and the ability to create new content and new ideas around all of that, it's just such an act of sustaining.
And also to put a serious idea in the midst of a very funny premise and a very funny execution up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Like this thing walks that treadmill? Walks that tightrope. It's not a treadmill. Walks that tightrope of pathos and comedy in this remarkable way where there's some fucking hysterical lines and moments and scenes, and there's some really dark, scary scenes in this thing, and they exist on the same continuum, and it just
works. The same second. I mean, yeah. there are things where if I weren't so moved by the underlying emotion and like, you know, insight, it would be the funniest idea and scene in the world. But yeah. there's and slash the opposite. Like if it weren't so funny, you know, I would be moved by the power of the idea. But it's like those things are constantly living together and without it breaking either. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't make the laughs less funny. It doesn't make the comedy less funny, and it doesn't make the emotion less real. It really like spins your head around about what power a comedy can possess,
mm-hmm.
because you can't really do this stuff outside of a comedy, you know? I mean, maybe you could, but I don't know that it'd be as thrilling.
Yeah. So Cameron Diaz, when she first enters the Malkovich brain, he's taking a shower and he's drying himself off, and she's like, oh, this feels amazing. Yeah. Oh, what is this? Oh, she like loves it, you know? And Cameron Diaz is playing on her classic, giggly self here to like, I would say great effect.
Oh, it really this movie, I know we just saw her in Fear and Loathing in Las mm-hmm. Vegas, but this movie, I was like, oh yeah, I love Cameron Diaz.
She's great here. She's playing on the things that she does well here, and it's anti The Mask, you know,
right.
totally different sort of
That's right.
different
yeah.
perspective. But the second time she goes in, John Malkovich is rehearsing lines and gets a phone call from a woman who's like, I kind of want to fuck you. Do you want to meet me? And she basically is like, you got to go to this thing, John Malkovich, in his head.
Well, and she, the woman who's called him is, we know, Catherine Keener.
But she does.
Because she's set Cameron Diaz up to be in his head when she makes that call. So mm-hmm. she's already, and you know, Catherine Keener's character here is somebody who's manipulating people. Her joy in life is puppeteering people, you know, manipulating them to do whatever she wants mm-hmm. for the sheer pleasure and fun of sick cruelty of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that seems to be what she's doing here with Cameron Diaz mm-hmm. is this would be great. This woman's having a crisis. I'm going to fuck her up. I'm going to fuck with her.
Mm-hmm.
That's like her first instinct.
Yeah. And so, so Cameron Diaz is like, I have to go back at 8 o'clock to go to this dinner. I need to do this. So she gets back in the head and Maxine shows up for the dinner and they basically fall in love.
Well, and Catherine Keener, I mean, this, like...
I don't want to go too deep in the rabbit hole.
No, but Catherine Keener is unexpectedly emotionally won over by the presence of
She can tell Diaz. Lottie is in John Malkovich's head, and she sees her feminine essence peering out
so
through his
eyes.
So
what she says is she sees a feminine essence, but what you discover is she's just getting off on having two people look at her at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is important and weirdly important in terms of understanding who that character is.
Yeah.
And because when.
Oh, jeez.
We'll speed through this thing.
Ahead.
So, because when, later, when John Cusack figures out this is what's happening, he makes Catherine Keener think Cameron Diaz will be inside and he goes in instead. And she has the exact same joy of sexual experience of having two people fuck her at the same time. And when she discovers it's him, she doesn't care.
She has maybe 10 seconds of going, what, huh? Okay. Like she just takes
it on. Well,
that's
fine. And actually, he's actually kind of better because he can manipulate the body.
Yeah, he's a better puppeteer.
Yeah.
Of John Malkovich.
So if I'm puppeting him, that seems to be a more, like, if I'm puppeting him,
she says,
and he's puppeting him.
She says, well, if he controls Malkovich and I control him, ..
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the actual
She gets
line.
To control two people. That's the joy of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, for,
which is great.
It's like so many layers of crazy.
So smart. Anyway, so that's the second act. Basically, they go through and there's this sort of both John Cusack and Cameron Diaz have fallen in love with this sociopath played by this woman, Catherine Keener, and they sort of wrestle over Malkovich's body until John Cusack basically puts Cameron Diaz in a cage, has her call Catherine Keener and say, hey, go, I'm going to go meet you in Malkovich's body. He goes in and then makes love to Catherine Keener and realizes, and she knows it's him at this point. She realizes it's him. And then takes permanent control over.
He figures out how he can stay in there. And so then the movie continues, which is then it cuts to 8 months later.
There's
basically
lots of movie left here at this point. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So then he finds out he can stay inside Malkovich, and he decides at that point that what he wants to do is control Malkovich like a puppet, which is his calling, and turn Malkovich into a professional puppeteer, which the movie has established is plausible in this world, and become the most renowned puppeteer in the world. And then Malkovich grows his hair John Cusack.
That's my favorite part. It's such a weird, interesting decision Malkovich gets stringy-haired and gross, but he doesn't have to. It's so great.
But he's starting to take on the persona of John Cusack in the movie.
And so for about 25 minutes of film, John Malkovich is doing a John Cusack impression. Like, very well.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. You can totally see that John Cusack is inside there.
Yeah.
And then, anyway, so then things happen. There's a whole subplot about how the vessels work.
This is important, I think. This is so hard to explain. John Cusack, wait to see how I do it, which is kind of confusing. Here's a bad choice I'm making. When John Cusack first gets the job on the 7th and a half floor, he watches an introductory video saying, why the 7 and a half floor thing? And it says, well, there was a sea captain guy who fell in love with a little person and built a floor for her, and they fell in love and he married her. And then later on, Cameron Diaz and John Cusack are having dinner at this mansion house owned by the boss of the company that John Cusack is working for. She tries to go to the bathroom, stumbles into a room that's a shrine to John Malkovich. There's pictures of him from every age, everywhere. And she's like, interesting. And as it turns out, the boss of the company, the owner of the company that John Cusack works for, is basically a guy who jumps from body to body using this portal he found when he built the 7th and a half floor. And he is the guy from the video being portrayed
in
the video.
He's the captain.
He's the sea captain.
Captain Merton.
Who has been waiting for John Malkovich's 44th birthday so he can enter the body and take over John Malkovich until the next child comes and he just hops from body to body to body.
No,
and
so the rule is, I mean, insanely, if you are inside, if you go in the portal within 15 minutes of midnight of his 44th birthday, you get to stay in there permanently.
Yeah.
The portal locks.
Yeah.
And it suddenly redirects to a different vessel.
Yeah.
Now,
the child, the bloodline of John,
of
that Malkovich.
Now, I'm gonna do something that you probably won't approve of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm confused about the rule.
No, don't
I'm
do
confused
this.
About one of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to talk it through.
No, let's do it.
When Is there a different... When does that portal become accessible to tourists for the little girl?
Instantly. I'd say it's accessible.
But John Cusack gets locked in her, which is, he says, happens if you go in after the 44th. So the rules.
No, if you go in, if no, what happens is, what the movie cuts around is this. It says if you go in when the child is a baby, the consciousness is too strong and you get sort of locked in there. And
so when it's happens not born.
Is, correct. Oh. And what happens is he chases after Catherine Keener and Cameron Diaz. Goes, I'm going to go back in. I'll kick him out. And we understand.
But the baby is not born yet.
Correct. And the
so
movie,
that's when she becomes available.
And the movie cut doesn't show us going going in.
No, I get that. But he thought he was going in Malkovich. So as soon as she's born, you could start going into the portal and being her.
I think so. But Cusack is locked.
Because he went in when she was still in Europe.
Because he thought he could kick out Captain Merton. Listeners, are you following any of this? Because
you know what this reminds me of?
Sticking to
this
it.
Is here's a funny thing, maybe. You know, we've had conversations like this about plot detail over Cocoon, over
Jumanji.
Sort of Jumanji, over, you know, other movies that are god awful that pack this many ideas. Cocoon has this many ideas. Maybe not this many, but it has nearly as many. It has a lot of fucking ideas.
Yeah.
And it's a shit show.
Well, they're not connected. It makes them hard to track.
But hearing this conversation, it's hard to understand that they're connected.
I bet that... Listen, I can't step outside of my body like John Cusack can. But I imagine this makes more sense than some of our episodes.
Yeah, probably.
Because I think that at least thematically it feels connected.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, this is arbitrary rules. And what happens is Catherine Keener and Cameron Diaz decide... Well, the movie tracks the new John Malkovich's puppeteering career for a good 10 minutes. Oddly.
Amazingly, it takes a beat, a few minutes, to just show a documentary about what's happened over the past
8 months.
8 months.
Yeah. Also, there's as Kaylin alluded to before, there that we inhabit the chimpanzee's brain POV for a while as we see his childhood trauma he suffered when he was captured. His parents were captured by whatever. So it's taking all these detours, but again, never feeling like you're killing time or off on some weird tangent. It always feels like perfectly tied in, explicating ideas. And then, Catherine Keener and Cameron Diaz
loaded.
End up together.
That's why. It's because they've loaded the gun on that chimp.
Yeah.
So when it comes, it's delightful because you feel it firing in a way you never knew this thing. Yeah. You didn't even know you were holding a weapon.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because when Cameron Diaz says repeatedly, my chimp has childhood trauma.
And he's in psychotherapy.
He's in psychotherapy. You think, oh, this is a character detail for Cameron Diaz telling us that she's pretty nutty.
Yeah.
And turns out, no, she's right.
Yeah. And that's like the genius of this script, which feels light and impulsive and almost freewheeling, but it is so slaved over. And I mean, maybe that's something I certainly appreciate now even more than I did then, which is this call and response, this layering of gags, this building of many, many different ideas on top of one another, all of which are building and paying off in sort of perfect synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
That he must have written this over and over.
Oh my
and
god,
over and
this
over
thing
and over
takes forever to write.
Yeah,
this is not a quick script. I mean, it's so first of all, the rules of the world need to be so precise for us to track this because it's a pretty complicated idea, really. If you think about it, people coming in, coming out. How does it work? So I know there's a lot of drafts of that and just the mechanical drafts of the script. And then to get the polish to make it work the way it does.
Well, and what I was alluding to earlier, and I should have actually looked this up to give myself a little bit more clarity, but what I was sort of implying or what I remembered about the, like, let's say the earlier drafts of the script before Spike Jonze came in and started working with Kaufman to kind of hone it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was like it ended with a giant... It ended with a gigantic puppet on puppet battle. You know, remember that scene where the puppeteer is doing a thing over the bridge?
Mm-hmm.
It ended with like two puppets fighting in this giant way. It began with Craig actively wearing women's clothing in order to try to find alternate identities and to expand his puppeteering skills and to sort of shed those big ideas and those kind of gaggy ideas, all of which are probably still roughly on the continuum, into this sort of molded, sculpted thing, is that's really what this movie has going for it, you know, above anything else that could be called whimsical, is like, it's been shorn of it. Amazingly, with this many ideas, it's been they knew which ones to cast away.
Yeah.
And there's not a single idea in this movie that I think shouldn't be there. There's not one that feels like it shouldn't be there. Maybe Charlie Sheen is one idea that maybe doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, we forgot to mention that Charlie Sheen has two different scenes in this film as a buddy of John Malkovich, which it can go because it didn't stick in my head as something memorable.
No, and he...
It feels shticky in a way the rest of the movie doesn't.
He feels shticky.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, maybe if they'd picked somebody other than Charlie Sheen. Like, at some point, John Malkovich mentions Gary Sinise, which is very funny.
Yeah.
And maybe it should have been him. Like, maybe that would have been funnier and more successful. But Charlie Sheen plays sort of a joke on Charlie Sheen and...
Yeah, and there's a bald cap Charlie Sheen 7 years down the line when he's doing his ridiculous puppeteering thing. Yeah, it's really yeah. Anyway, that's the plot of the film. I don't think all the other movies you named, maybe not Election, but the other movies that came out this year feel like they're coming out of a time period. I mean, even American Beauty feels rooted in that time period to me when I think back on them. This one just refuses to adhere to a specific era. I mean, there's things you clock that are 90s specific, but on any metaphor or plot level, it doesn't feel like it's dealing with themes that are necessarily connected to that time
period.
There's
not, I mean, I don't know what you mean when you say 90s specific. Do you mean like there's a cell phone that doesn't look like our phones? Like there is that?
No, I mean, there's like details. You're like, oh yeah, this for sure happens in the 90s, but
storytelling
wise, it feels out of time.
Yeah. The only thing that I'm looking at my DVD shelf right now and I'm seeing, you remember those, you wouldn't know this, but when they, in the like early 2000s, maybe, or late 90s, somewhere around there, they put out these DVD sets of like the work of Spike Jonze, the work of Michel Gondry, and the work of who else? Jonathan Glazer. You know, so I'm looking at these sets over here, and it does remind me of that time when there was this, and this is what 1999 was about. There was this extraordinary crop of filmmakers who made their bones making brilliant music videos, and Fincher exists.
Fincher, yeah.
You know, all these guys. These are sets of their videos and commercials. And it reminded me of what a vital feeling moment that was, where these guys had honed their visual aesthetics in outside of narratives. And now right here, first movie by Spike Jonze, they were starting to emerge as narrative storytellers.
Mm.
And how fucking exciting that felt, because him and Michel Gondry and eventually Glazer too, they all brought a very different look to their films than was currently existing. And it didn't feel indie. It didn't feel like Kevin Smith. You know, it didn't feel even like Tarantino. They were way more evolved visually than that when they first came out of the gate.
Mm.
And that, I remember the feeling of excitement watching, because when Being John Malkovich came out, a movie didn't really look like that. And Spike Jonze had been working with little things like that, you know, that verite doc looking camera style to shoot kind of hyper expressive videos. He had been fucking around with the Fatboy Slim stuff. He was doing Jackass stuff. Like, all of that was right around the same time. And it felt very alive and exciting. And then, of course, Michel Gondry, you could say the exact same thing, although in a very different way. And that thrill, I really feel we've lost in terms of new filmmakers. And I wonder now, do they simply not have a place to cultivate visual talent? Mm-hmm. Do we not have a place to cultivate great visual artists?
Well, I think that's probably a huge part of it. And I think that a lot of the people who come out of film school are swinging for the gates, you know, swinging for the fences really, really fast and trying to get that, you know, Gareth Edwards Monsters film or something like that that just gets them the big budget, gets them in the system, gets them in the pipeline faster. Whereas the idea that you would spend 5 to 7 years directing music videos or cool commercials feels like turning their wheels, I think, to a lot of filmmakers today, young filmmakers or friends of ours, I think, who come out of film school.
Right.
They want to, you know, they're getting money for a feature. They're all getting their feature prepped, getting their, you know, I got the script. We got this feature we're doing.
Yeah, we'll give you a television series.
Yeah, right, which has an established visual aesthetic you have to slot into and sort of ape.
Yeah. And which you have to kind of polish down. I mean, you know, it reminds me, the other thing about this is it reminds me of the joy of movies. Mm. Movies. You can contain so many ideas in movies. And too often with our sort of era right now, it feels, and look, I'll just be open. I'm talking about Stranger Things.
Mm.
That is a movie. It should be a movie and it should have a lot more ideas rather than a television show that seems to me, and I'm speaking only for myself, sped through the creative process and not baked, and it runs out. It has a poverty of ideas. And I feel like that's, there's something that television encourages about speed and, you know, ill-considered or unfinished ideas and projects. And this movie is just so beautifully composed.
The fact that you can tell which ideas are baked indicates that you should always bake your ideas. Like Roger Rabbit, you can feel it. Mad Max Fury Road, you can feel it. This movie, you can feel it. You know when a movie's not baked all the way just because the ideas aren't there.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about basic storytelling, although some movies fail on that metric as well. I mean, you know, a decently well-told story that holds up to any sort of level of character scrutiny and plot details sometimes feels underbaked just because you're like, yeah, that did the job, but there were a lot of opportunities that feel missed. It feels sparse. It feels empty.
And they feel satisfied with a couple.
Enough. It's enough, yeah. You know? And whereas, you know, this movie is a great example of just cramming things in.
Well, and so my other question to you is why, because maybe I'm wrong, but I work in LA, and there was a time when a new Charlie Kaufman script was the event of the moment, the event of the year. And this year, or last year, I guess, he had a new film come out, Anomalisa, and it was mildly noticed. But it was creative and great. It wasn't as good as Being John Malkovich. It was really, really good. And he seems to have fallen out of favor, and his brand of creativity seems to have actually kind of gone away. Like this, I was watching this movie thinking, like, why isn't this... Is it just because it's impossible to match? Like, why isn't this held up as the ideal achievement, as the thing that we should all be swinging for as young, you know, relatively embryonic filmmakers and storytellers? And surely that was the case for a minute. So did he, what happened that now we're sort of settling again?
I don't know. I don't know if it's a development process or if it's the way the studio system. I think the statistics are, you know, you have room for maybe 4 original scripts a year or something in the main thing. Yeah. The rest is remakes or adaptations.
Well, and to the point where he can't get a movie made.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it is a little fiscal insecurity. I don't want to blame it all on that. But I also think that he's different than Shyamalan for sure, but when you have the new idea and you become entranced by it, it's almost what happens with musicians too. That first album takes forever to craft, and you put it out. The second album is okay, and the third album becomes
okay. But let's go into the Charlie Kaufman hole for a second, because Eternal Sunshine is excellent. Mm-hmm. It's probably not as good as Malkovich, but it's incredible.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
Adaptation is incredible, incredibly good as an immediate follow up. And Synecdoche, New York is the towering masterpiece of any career. It is, I mean, that movie is one of my favorite movies. And it's I mean, it takes the number of ideas in Malkovich and quintuples them and sustains the same act of beautiful, perfect pitch, perfect execution, not a bad idea contained within it, and is endlessly rewatchable for its depth. And so,
is it that it requires more of the audience?
Well, this movie was a hit, and that was not, you know, and that movie was not just commercially, but critically. Like, the people loved Malkovich and were like, this is very exciting.
Yeah.
Synecdoche is too fucking much.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, okay, is that why we don't talk about Malkovich so much anymore?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that it's an easily parsable idea. We talk about Fight Club because it has an easily parsable idea to hold on to. Whereas Malkovich, you know, it's about a guy who hates himself.
See, that's exactly that. Yeah. I think you just nailed it. And I thought it while you said it, which is that it's, you can't replicate the core emotions. You can replicate the tricks of Fight Club.
Yeah.
And it has ideas, but they're much more approachable ideas. And Malkovich douses its unapproachable, prickly self with whimsy. And somehow in the moment, I think that's what people were so taken with. But they didn't realize what a painful core this movie has. And that it's chosen a deeply unlikable and pathetic main character. And so, which is something that Charlie Kaufman obviously has continued to explore, but like Synecdoche takes that to the next level of he's unbearable, he's almost unbearable to be around, and you like you just try to love this guy, and you know you do.
Who are the challenging filmmakers this year and last year? Like, who are the people slotting into a space, just out of, as a thought exercise, who are the filmmakers challenging audiences in ways that make you lean in and work a little bit?
Ben Wheatley made High Rise, and all his movies are challenging and incredible. I hated this movie, but Nicholas Refn did The Neon Demon, which is intending to be challenging, but it's just a bad riff on Mulholland Drive. Who else? Like, I was thinking about my favorite movies of the year the other day and yesterday, and I could have done this then, but I can't remember.
I wonder if what I'm driving at, I guess, is, are any of these guys doing necessarily better than Charlie Kaufman?
Well, no, they're all different artists, but
right. So I just wonder if, like,
nobody's burying their fucking heart the way that he did.
Well, there's just a slot that's just a smaller slot now, and I think it's all the things we've talked about, but it's partly a cultural shift away from things that escapist entertainment, quote unquote, that makes you work is less in vogue, you know? And we run into this on the other podcast a lot, is that people who like to work a little bit when they read books or watch films love Mad Max, and people who don't like to work hate it. And there's a schism there, you know? If you work at it, it rewards you. If you don't, it doesn't. And I think...
But of course, the person who, quote unquote, doesn't like the work would never frame it that way.
Oh, of course not. No. I mean, it's a very judgmental way of framing it.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, I hate when I fall into this pit, and it's my fault for doing it. We're being very judgmental and critical of our contemporary moment. And let's not frame it that way. Let's just talk about this movie, not as something that's lost or you know, but it's something that can easily be reclaimed or celebrated just for itself. I mean, that's the point of this show, right? Is to, you know, this movie, whether it's faded from memory or cultural memory or not, or the kind of pop culture vogue, it's a masterpiece. It's a fucking masterpiece. Yeah. And it's something that everyone, I think, who might be interested in film or might be interested in making movies should look at as a real example of, and to study in terms of how you pull off a thrilling experience, a cinematic experience on every possible level. I mean, and look, I also don't want to say that I think this movie is completely perfect. It makes big leaps of character logic and big sort of, it asks you to swallow major shifts in terms of the things that they do. And it kind of gets away with that by being a comedy and being hyper real. But sometimes I felt once in a while, okay, that's a bit of a shortcut.
There's a couple moments I thought, well, there's a couple moments that went for the gag instead of the real moment. Like, I'm specifically thinking of the moment where Catherine Keener is sitting between John Cusack and Cameron Diaz, and she's smoking a cigarette. And she's talking about, if you're a passionate, there's two types of people in the world. There's passionate people who go after what they want, and then the other people, fuck them, who cares anyway? And when she finishes that, both Cameron Diaz and John Cusack leap on her to make out with her.
Yeah.
That felt sticky.
Well, and to that point, where I think that the movie probably most lets down on its emotional truth is in them processing the collapse of their marriage. That just kind of goes away. Mm-hmm. They're basically quick to move on, which is, again, it's funny. It's a comedy idea almost that they're so quick to abandon each other for this other woman, but it's not really explored. And when you think it might be, it kind of just doesn't. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, that's okay because the movie doesn't need to linger there. It could have. And I think that Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman grew in a certain kind of emotional maturity where they could do those kinds of stories. I think Spike Jonze did it in Her. I think he really looked at what it is to be in love with somebody. And Spike Jonze Kaufman certainly did it in Synecdoche, because he did everything in Synecdoche. He made the movie about life. One time, by the way, I went to a double feature of Synecdoche, New York, and Tree of Life.
I was about to say Tree of Life is probably the worst combo.
Took me years to get over it.
Yeah. That sounds emotionally traumatizing.
Oh, my God. It was so heavy.
Cognitively traumatizing. I think that the big takeaway for me, just on a personal, professional level, is that you cannot get around hard work. And I think that there's this myth of the idea that springs to life and it becomes very easy. And I think that's an annoyingly, weirdly pervasive myth amongst creatives in every field.
And I think Charlie Kaufman has probably been combating that since this movie came out, because it feels, again, it feels spontaneous and effortless. But if you have ever tried to write anything or conceive of anything in total, holy shit, do you see how much hard work it is?
Oh, And the pieces, and just, again, there's two elements to this, more than two elements, but the mechanics of the script are not simple. to construct. And right. then the emotional arcs are not simple to construct. And the moving pieces of making sure things, guns on the wall, fire at appropriate times that feel both plot-driven, emotionally-driven, and can fire those guns. It's tough. It is
that's
real
all,
tough.
That's all true about the hard work, but it's also, you know, what this movie sort of, I think it can teach somebody. Whether you want to do that kind of conceptual hard work or not, you don't have to. You can make a great movie without doing that much building and construction. But what you can't do, and what I think everyone should remember, is that, and what this movie does also, just this is the reason it's a total genius masterpiece, it comes from a real core of personal truth. It is a real, real hard, honest human emotion at the center of this. Something he wanted to or needed to express about himself in terms of what he was feeling. I mean, he's doing emotional journalism, which, you know, I can think of nothing else more valuable than somebody just reporting honestly on the state of their being. And that sounds like something that in a Charlie Kaufman script you would make fun of,
yeah,
and you would find comedy in, and great, but that's all, it's also true. It's also yeah. there, and he's not hiding it.
Yeah. I mean, and what's great about this is just, it does have a simple sci-fi premise, this thing. And it's about a simple sci-fi metaphor, which a lot of the best sci-fi films are simple premises married to simple metaphors. What if you hate yourself, and what if you could be someone else? Right. It's exploded, you know, to take a simple premise and explode it like that. It just, to me, shows how you should approach these concepts. And I think, I bet you this movie becomes part, a larger part of the conversational lexicon of creativity amongst us. Yeah. As we go forward, I just yeah. expect that will sort of work its way in.
Makes total sense to me.
So watch it again, I guess.
Why not?
You want to say? I mean, I feel like no. I don't want to parse it anymore. I feel like it's a great movie. And
no, hopefully you've all seen Being John Malkovich, and
don't you will judge be our audience. Please,
well, I mean, I don't mean like that. You would be a bad person, but
hey, you fucking idiots.
This watch would be a hard, hard, maybe it, this would be a hard episode you. To listen to. But go watch it. And if you've seen it once, see it again. If you've seen it five times, see it a sixth time. It's amazing, and it will never let you down.
Great. Ever.
It's always there for you.
It's the Rick Astley of the film community. I'm going to pull again.
Can I tell you something weird?
Yeah, please.
Last night, I dreamed that you pulled a Pedro Almodovar movie.
Oh, my God. What if I do?
That would... How fucking crazy. I don't even know if there's any in here. Wouldn't that be insane?
Yeah. Oh, this is good. This is we actually pulled a big one.
Oh, really?
I pulled a big one for the podcast.
Oh,
yeah.
I cannot wait.
I'm just going to say it.
Please.
Flight of the Navigator.
Oh, wow.
This is a big one.
People have been yeah. asking yeah. for this.
This is a big one for this
Holy
era.
Holy shit.
Are we prepared to do something so big?
This is a really big one because I don't know. I don't know. Well, let's save it. Let's save it for the next episode, which you must listen to.
Join us next week for Flight of the Navigator on...
Does Your Favorite Movie
Suck?